Hey, this is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week's guest is Matt Fitzgerald. Matt is an author of many, many books. He's a runner. He's a coach. He's a scientist of sorts. And on this show, we talk all about mindset. One of the main topics of his books is all about the mindset of a champion or a competitor's mindset. And he's got this great book called How Bad Do You Want It? And so we dive into some of the big topics in that book. And one of the main things is this idea that if you have two athletes with the exact same physical capabilities, the one with the greater mental fitness is going to prevail. And that's not a real new concept to any of you, but I've noticed that even though this topic has become so much more popular over the past few years, so many of you still don't know how to put it into practice. And so my goal with this show was to gain some knowledge from this expert on mindset of exactly how you can practice and train your mind. And that's exactly what we do. We talk about things like perceived exertion and relationship with failure and lots of other really cool things. I hope you enjoy this show as much as I did. What's up, Matt? I'm really excited to do this interview with you, man. As I was just telling you during my research, I started to get really fired up about it because one of the things you're most passionate about is mindset, which is one of my biggest passions in life as well. So, you know, I know that you and I can go in a million different directions given your expertise, but selfishly, I'm gonna steer this towards mindset. So I'm really excited to do this. Thanks for making some time for me, man.
You bet. My pleasure.
So in general, you're a really successful guy. You're a writer, researcher, coach. You wear lots of different hats and you do them very, very well. How do you personally approach goal setting and setting intentions for the year, if at all? And including how you do it with your athletes?
Yeah, I mean, for myself, it's very intuitive, very by the gut. I'm really ruled by, I would say, my passion and my curiosity. So I always have an agenda. I'm not the sort of person who goes through fallow periods where I'm like, what next? Usually I've got eight things I want to do and I only have time, you know, for three of them now and I got to wait on the other five. That's just the way I've always been wired. I'm a chip off the old block. My dad, who's also a writer and was a runner back in the day, is exactly the same way, which I view as a gift, you know, just because, you know, talent is another thing, but like if you're just fired up and you have something you really want to do, mm-hmm. That's half the battle right there. It's something you can't instill in another, you know, in as far as the coaching goes, you know, everyone's got their own motivational style, but even so, as a coach, I like to I don't like to set goals for my athletes. I'll tell them if they've got something crazy they want to do and that they shouldn't do. But usually if someone comes to me and says, oh, I just finished a half marathon, what should I do next? I say, you tell me, because the purpose of your next goal is to, you know, make you fired up to keep training. That's really, so any goal that does that is a good goal. So I really try to let them drive the bus, and I just kind of course correct for them when they're being silly.
Gotcha. How have you developed this, like, this passion and enthusiasm that you have for what you do? Is that just something you picked up from your dad, or has it been cultivated? Has it been intentional? Can you explain any of that?
Yeah, it just, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, these analogies can be dangerous because I don't want to compare myself to geniuses, but there are, you know, noteworthy people out there who, if you dig into their story, you know, maybe let's say it's a guitarist and they say, you know, the first time I picked up the instrument at age six, I just knew, you know, that was the life for me. Like, that's kind of me. You know, definitely with the writing, I think I was nine when I decided that I wanted to be a writer when I grew up, and I never changed my mind at any point. You know, I was writing, you know, they say writers write, they don't dream about it. And that's what I was doing from age nine on. Every day I was writing, like in school, outside of school. And then, you know, sports were kind of my dad is a very physical guy. He when he was young, before I was born, he would do these crazy long distance solo swims, like across Lake Ontario and stuff. And then he joined the Navy and became a SEAL during Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
Also very physical, but also, you know, obviously, you know, mental as well. And then he became a runner, so he was running marathons. And by this time, you know, I'm a sentient being, and I'm watching him do it. And I think, well, I want to do that. And you know, from the moment I tried it, I just loved, you know, testing my physical and mental limits, and just could never get enough of it.
And then, so I think that's really unique. That's amazing that you've had that experience. But it's very, very unique that someone would have such passion at such a young age.
Yes.
And I'm sure you get questions all the time from different clients about how to create motivation or passion. Do you have any suggestions you give to people on cultivating passion for themselves if they don't have something that they just grew up absolutely loving?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think it's not something that you can put inside another person, but you can help them clear out the clutter that sort of gets in the way. I think a lot of people operate under a sense of obligation. Like, you know, I can't do that because what will people think? Or I can't do that because it's risky. But that's, you know, that none of that is actually true. you know, people who succeed in pursuing their passions are the ones who just kind of don't give a shit and they do it anyway. And yeah, you can crash and burn sometimes. You know, that comes with it. But you end up, you know, if that's the way you live, you end up without regrets. So that's what I try to, that's the talk I try to have with people about passion. I don't think you can motivate another person, but you can shift their perspective so they think, hey, you know what, why not? You know, let me start listening to my voice inside my head versus all the other voices.
Right. One thing that's been really helpful for me too is to shift how I think about passion and motivation in general, in terms of we love what we're good at. Right. To a certain extent, we love what we're good at. And so, for instance, when I started this podcast, it was nothing but me just about to shit my pants every single time. And I actually like weaseled my way out of a few scheduled podcasts for various poor excuses because I was so afraid. And I really hated it. I just did it because I knew it was a good way to like build trust in the community. But over time, as I got better at it, as I got more comfortable with it, it's developed into this just sincere passion to, you know, I get to have really interesting conversations with cool people like you. And it's because I've constantly worked on and honed the craft. And I think one of the biggest things people run into is they stop progressing, they stop growing. And whatever in any discipline in life in general, once we get complacent, I think it becomes boring and we lose interest. So having like a mastery mentality can definitely help with that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like, I mean, that's exactly how I operate. It's all about trying to perfect the craft. As an athlete, it's tougher. You know, I'm 46 now, so you know it's hard to keep improving, but you can still improve your methods, you know. So maybe you know age is slowing me down, but I can still train better than I ever have before. So you know, there's still, you know, that journey can continue. And certainly as a writer, you know, my dad is 74 now, and he's doing his best work. So that's, you know, that's a great role model to right. have. And yeah, so it's, you know, improvement is intoxicating, and it keeps the fire lit for sure. So yeah, I totally agree on that point.
You strike me as someone that thinks about his own thinking a lot, and which really resonates with me. And I notice, and I may be off base with this, but I notice one of your programs is called like 80-20. And does that have any relation to Pareto's principle?
It actually doesn't, you know, okay. That's, I mean, it's the first thing you would think. It actually refers to an optimal intensity balance for endurance training. But you know what, if you really want to like force it a bit, there is a connection to be made there for sure.
right? Staying out of the moderate intensity, right? Which is right. The bulk of what people are doing. They're doing moderate intensity training and not getting much better. So we won't go down that rabbit hole, but where I was leading is that, are there any mental models that you use that you would recommend to others, such as Pareto's principle?
Not any single one. The inspiration for, you know, a lot of my most recent work is this psychobiological model, which is, it's finally like sort of psychology growing up, or hard science finally talking to, you know, the softer sciences, or the humanistic sorts, for the first time. So that's a model of endurance performance that really looks at the intersection of psychology, lived experience, and neurology and biology as well, because both matter. Both right. are part of it. Both count. It's a pretty rich model, and fairly new and developing rapidly, and has a lot of practical applications as well.
Well, let's dive into it then. So I want to talk about the concept, kind of the main concept of your book, How Bad Do You Want It? It seems to be that about developing what you call mental fitness rather than mental toughness. And I really appreciate that distinction, because it implies that it's something to be trained rather than an innate gift that only some people have. One thing that you talk about in there is that something to the effect that the attitude you have in everyday life is the attitude that you will bring to sport. Is that
right?
Am I on the right track? So what does this mean, and why is that the case?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you only have one mind, so it's not, obviously I'm in the world of endurance sports, so that's where all my examples come from. But, you don't, as a runner, you don't step onto the start line, onto the race course, and flip a switch and suddenly apply a bunch of coping skills and, mental aptitudes and weaknesses that aren't operative in your everyday life as well. Mm-hmm. There's an epigraph at the front of my book from a novel called The Power of One. And the line is, the mind is the athlete. And that says it right there. So, whatever mental strengths you have that help you at work, in relationships, in the crises that occur in everyday life, those are the same things you're going to apply as an athlete. The same weaknesses you have on the job and relationships are going to be the things that hold you back in training and competition as well.
Man, that is such a fundamental concept that you're laying out. The idea that I bring this up on many podcasts, but how you do anything in your life is how you do everything. And it's so true. Like, you don't just flip a switch and then all of a sudden you're using visualization exercises and all of a sudden only in sport you're focusing on what you can control and what you can't. It's got to be all the time or none of the time.
Yep. Which is, that's the beauty of it, because that's what makes sport such an incredible growth opportunity, because you actually, speaking of crises, to go back to my marathon example, when you get, 23 miles into a marathon and it's getting real and you're just suffering, in a way that you just don't, and unless you're lucky enough to, get stuck in a bank heist or something, it's a full on crisis, and it's just you alone with your soul. And stuff comes out, you're just reaching for lifelines, and you learn about yourself. And often it's disappointing because, inevitably, you do fail as a result of, parts that are missing in your mental makeup. But those are such incredible opportunities to work on that stuff and get better. And it's so satisfying when you make progress in those ways.
Yeah, I really hope some people hear this and understand that it's not just about a couple habits and practices to bring into the gym or onto the track or field, that it can happen in every area of your life, because that gives you access to just so much power in every aspect of your life. So I hope people really understand what you're saying. In a second, I'm going to talk to you about one of the main points in the book, which is perceived exertion. But first off, mental toughness, mindset training, all of those types of things are kind of it's an increasingly hot topic in the sports and fitness world. And it seems like people are still really struggling to make practical use of the information. So what mistakes do you see people making in regards to training their mind? And what do you think are the things or thing that is not effective in terms of improving mindset?
I really feel like the foundation, you know, step one is intent. It has to be a problem that you articulate as such. You know, that's how it started for me, you know, having peeked into the book, you know, I tell a bit of my story as an athlete in there. And I was mentally weak as a high school runner. It caused me to, you know, not fulfill my potential, even to quit the sport for many years. And when I got back into it, I didn't want to just realize my unfulfilled potential as an athlete. I wanted to get that monkey off my back of viewing myself as a mentally weak person. And so I was very intentional about it. I didn't know how to fix it. I just knew that I wanted to, but that turned out to be, you know, the most important first step. So, you know, if, you know, anyone who wants to take a similar journey, you have to articulate it. Just like, you know, my insecurity holds me back. My lack of confidence holds me back. My, you know, whatever it is. And then you set to work on it. And yes, you know, the tools for working on it are come next, but without the intent, you're just sort of hoping, and you know, you're not going to get anywhere that way.
So then you consider yourself a mentally weak athlete at this point, you know, having met all of the elite athletes that you've met and coaches that you've met, have you gotten to a place where you would consider yourself relatively strong?
Yes. Yeah, very much so. I mean, that's, yes. You know, one thing I realized only later was that I was harder on myself than a lot of athletes are. So, you know, when I quit in high school, I thought I was the weakest, you know, runner in the state of New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. and that turned out not to be true. It's just I was not where I should be, but I was also holding myself to a high standard. And I had to mature a lot before I recognized that. Because now as a coach, I realize that, you know, a lot of people need work in this regard. You know, there's some wimpiness out there. You know, everyone's average there's a bell curve on all of these and all these psychological characteristics. So not everyone is tough. A lot of people are sort of in the middle. But yeah, no, I've come a long way. And now when I race, I feel like it's a real advantage for me. My mental game is an advantage that I'm conscious of now, which is light years from where I started out.
Right. I definitely had that sense, and I wanted people to understand that it's not just something that they can overcome a weakness, but they can make into a strength, which I think is very powerful.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, it's, you know, results not typical. I don't know, but that's my story, you know, and so it proves, and you know, I'm no one special. So I think, you know, if that transformation is possible for me, I like to think it's possible for anyone.
So one of the biggest concepts in your book is this one of perceived exertion. What is it, and what are kind of all the factors related to perceived exertion?
Yeah. So perceived exertion is a perception like any other. So you have, sight, you know, vision, you have hearing, you have taste. These are all perceptions, tactile perceptions. You can perceive heat, you know, temperature. So exertion is just another one of those, and it's discrete. There's a lot of parallels between perceived exertion and pain, but it's not pain. So what it really is it's your global sense of how hard you're working at any given moment, you know, how hard you're working relative to your limit. So you can experience a very high level of perceived exertion if you just take off sprinting, because you're working at your limit, you know, from the gun. It's a maximal effort. So, you know, you perceive that, but you can also take off running at a slow jog and keep going until fatigue sets in, At which point you will also have a very high level of perceived effort. It takes a long time to get there, but you've come up against your limit in another way. And in terms of where it comes from, there's people who know maybe a little bit of physiology might think, oh, it probably comes from feedback from, you know, from the body to the brain. But that seems to be not the case, that perceived effort is really feed forward, that it's about how hard certain parts of the brain are working to drive the body to move.
I mean, this is a really, really sexy concept for athletes, right? Like the idea is that two athletes of the same exact physical capacity, the one that has the better relationship to perception of exertion is going to win, right? The one with the stronger mindset is going to win. What things contribute to how we perceive exertion? Is it outside stress in relationships and career? Is it genetics? Is it the way we were brought up? What things, in your opinion, are related to this?
I mean, it's really everything. So because everything gets filtered through this mechanism. Like, you know, there are a lot of ways to measure, you know, effort. You can wear a heart rate monitor, right? But you can also not wear a heart rate monitor. Perceived effort, there's no off switch for that. It's always on, and it's always inextricably linked to your actual effort level. So anything, literally anything at all that could possibly, affect mind or body during exertion, it can be a factor. So caffeine is one of them. You know, if you take caffeine and work out, caffeine, acts on certain parts of the brain that are responsible for perceived effort. So it's, you know, caffeine is known to enhance athletic performance. How does it do so? By making it feel easier. Or at least that's how it affects endurance performance. It can also just kind of make your brain work faster, activate your muscles more quickly. That's kind of a separate issue. So there's that. Motivation is one. So there was an interesting study that showed that male subjects in an exercise lab environment rated their perceived effort in some sort of endurance test lower when it was a female technician asking.
Oh, wow.
But these things are real, you know. Yep. Like these things can actually be performance enhancing. So, you know, as an athlete, you want to know the whole list, you know, anything you can, you know, that can possibly change your relationship to either increase your maximum tolerance for perceived effort or to reduce the amount of effort you perceived at any given level of, you know, any given work rate. So, you know, either way, and it really is a very long list.
Well, man, the list so far is great. We got caffeine and we got chicks. If we can get like ice cream in the mix, then I think I can do some serious training.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a third one that's just as good. Well, there are other drugs. Oh, I know, zapping your brain. That's a good one. Electromagnetic stimulation of certain parts of your brain does the same thing. It sounds like, you know, from another, from the future, but it actually works. You know, if you stimulate certain parts of the brain and then go out and do like a time trial, it'll feel easier and you'll be able to put out more watts.
Got it. And you're not talking about neurofeedback. You're talking about actual electrical stimulation.
Yeah. Transcranial electrical stimulation. Yeah.
Got it. So let's talk about how we can train this. I know you bring up the term inhibitory control in relation to this. How do we train our ability to overcome these inhibitions? And let's just start there.
Yeah, inhibitory control is a good one. It's a mouthful. It's a simple concept. It refers the ability to sort of stay focused on a long-term goal despite short-term temptations or distractions that are not compatible with the longer-term goal. The example I always give is wanting to lose 10 pounds and wanting that slice of German chocolate cake sitting in front of you. It's like you can't have both. One you can have right now, mm-hmm. One you've got to wait for. So it's a matter of like, okay, if you really want to lose 10 pounds, then of course you could have one. It's just an analogy, but
no, totally.
Yeah. So you have to inhibit the impulse that is tempting you to eat the chocolate cake so you can stay focused on the long-term goal. In endurance sports, it's, you know, the goal of reaching the finish line as quickly as possible versus the incompatible goal of not suffering. Mm-hmm. So, you know, anytime you're out there and it's getting serious in a race, you've got, an angel on your left shoulder saying, keep going, and a devil on your right, actually I think it's the other way around, saying, stop, this hurts. And inhibitory control is the ability to, listen to the angel and tune out the devil.
Right. And how do we train that?
Yeah. So, one way is to actually just train physically. You know, anytime your body's moving, your brain's going along for the ride. So just by exposing yourself, to these situations where you have to make that choice, mm-hmm. Endurance exercise is shown to actually enlarge like the anterior cingulate cortex and other parts of the brain that are, you know, the seats of inhibitory control, that they grow like a muscle just through the exercise, because your brain is as active as any muscle in exercise.
You're essentially you're making that decision over and over and over throughout one session.
Right. But you can also practice, you can sort of bootstrap your way to better inhibitory control in your everyday life by, you can choose, certain challenges, certain goals you have that you have to overcome temptations to achieve. But, if maybe you've got like five of those, you choose the easiest one. And then if you're trying to, build strength, you start with a load you can manage. And once that's easy, you move on to a bigger one. So maybe if you're trying to, just give up some bad habit, like, looking at your, Twitter feed too often, it sounds silly, but it's all the same. It's the same mechanism. Inhibitory control is inhibitory control, whether it's in the gym or it's, in your family room at home. So, it doesn't matter where you begin to train it. It will benefit you. It's totally transferable.
Going back to perceived exertion, what effect does body language have on this?
Yeah, that's another one on the very long list. Obviously anyone who's ever worked out before or seen someone else work out is familiar with kind of the ugly grimacing faces people make, quite naturally at high levels of exertion. And, scientists sort of ask, well, why is that? Is it arbitrary or is it substantive? And Sam Wellemarkora, the guy who wrote the foreword to my book and is kind of the father of the psychobiological model, he did a study where he found that actually if you override that impulse to grimace and just sort of, make your face sort of neutral and placid and relaxed, despite working hard physically, it actually slightly reduces perception of effort. Now that's not something you would want to do if you were trying to go for a maximal lift or run a 100-meter dash. Then it doesn't matter how much effort you're perceiving. You're just trying to maximize your effort, and grimacing helps you maximize your effort. In endurance sports, where you can run whatever pace you're running for a while, you're just going to get tired at that pace eventually. Then you want to be as relaxed and comfortable as you can possibly be. And so that's the situation where you would want to use that. But I use it in a slightly different way in races all the time, where it's sort of the never let them see you sweat adage, where if I'm in a pack of athletes and I want to beat all of them to the finish line, I try to consciously look like it's an absolute cakewalk, that I'm coasting. I don't want them to hear me breathing. I don't want them to see me grimacing. Mm-hmm. And it's partly to psych them out, but it also makes you feel better, just by controlling your body language in that way.
So we coached a team this year called the Wasatch Brutes that won the CrossFit Games, and they beat out one of the most successful teams in the history of CrossFit. And one thing that the announcers talked about a lot, and the team themselves, was this this idea of not showing that they were working hard. Like people, people looked at them from the stands and thought they're just so much fitter than everyone else because of the expression they had on their face. So they went through such grueling workouts all throughout the weekend that it can be really intimidating if you look over and you're about to pass out and someone else looks like they're just taking a walk in the park.
Yep. Yeah. Cyborgs. Like what?
Yep.
What's in these people?
So our relationship to the word or the concept of failure and making mistakes is one of the most important aspects of training and development in any discipline. How can we develop a positive relationship with failure if we don't already have one?
Yeah. I mean, you know, nobody wants to fail, but, you know, failure is good for you as an athlete. In the book, I talk about the case of Cadel Evans, an Australian cyclist who was sort of born to win the Tour de France. He was like, he got started in the sport early. He showed just once in a generation talent. He had all the best coaches and resources. He just won everything. He started off as a mountain biker. Eventually, he makes his Tour de France debut. He loses, comes back the next year, loses again. And suddenly it's like he's not the young superstar anymore. Like other people are winning. He's getting a little long in the tooth. He loses six times before he realized that the one thing that he was missing was the resilience that comes from failure, from failing and not giving up. And so I call it, well, it's actually another psychiatrist I quote in the book refers to it as sweet disgust, where you just get fed up. And you see people who are just like, you know, determined, like not again. You can get a level of determination from failure that you just can't fake and you really can't come about by another way. So, you know, it's often said that, you know, failure is a learning opportunity, and that's true, but that's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about sort of the emotional advantage that you can gain from failing and sort of being angry about it.
Right. Yeah. That's one that I haven't really considered. The one that usually is brought up is the idea of it, of kind of reframing it as a mistake and a learning opportunity, but I've not heard about it in the way you just described it. I like that.
Yeah. I mean, anger, let's face it, you know, it's useful.
Right.
So, you know, elsewhere in the book, I talk about, you know, the chip on your shoulder thing, you know, just tell me I can't, because that is going to ensure that I can. You know, that's another way of harnessing anger as an athlete. So, you know, you don't want to become an angry person just for the sake of winning. But, you know, you can certainly use that very natural emotion to your benefit as an athlete.
Man, for a competitive person, especially a masculine person, hearing those words, you can't, is just absolute gold.
Yes. Yep. Tell me I can't.
Exactly. Oh man, that's just the best fuel you can ask for. So I listened to your podcast that you did on the Mind Muscle Project, and you spoke on there about, you know, people choking under a lot of pressure. And I really loved how you talked about overcoming it. And the way that you framed it is that we choke when our focus is on ourselves. And I thought this was really interesting, because I listened to it just days ago. And about a month ago, I was at this big speaking conference put on by this guy, Brendon Burchard, who's one of the biggest speakers in the world. And he said, if you have issues with public speaking, if you get afraid on stage, then simply shift your how you're viewing it from yourself to what you can contribute to others, right? Mm-hmm. And literally, as that thought is going through my mind, you said exactly that. Like that's one of the biggest ways to get over public speaking, is to shift your mindset, basically. So
yeah, picture everyone naked.
Exactly. So how do you, are there any cues or practices that can help people to snap out of this in the moment when they're feeling a lot of pressure in a situation, whether it be in sport or, you know, their career or some kind of event?
Yeah. I mean, it's exactly that. I mean, there's basically two directions in which you can focus your attention, internally or externally. Obviously, you know, in most circumstances, it's a blend of both, but it's mostly one or the other. You're most likely to choke and to, feel and cave into pressure when, you're too focused on yourself. So, the way to overcome that or prevent it is to concentrate on the task at hand. And so it's just really concrete stuff. I always go back to my endurance examples, but, in a race, it's, focusing on the back of the athlete in front of you, mm-hmm. focusing on, the mile markers, your split times, the gradient of the hill that's coming up, concrete stuff that is, they're the elements of the task you're trying to perform, versus how am I feeling? How am I doing? I mean, that should be background. It shouldn't be your primary focus. What are people going to think if I come up short, that type of thing.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's a very small distinction, right?
Yes. And it requires, the first step always is self-awareness, mm-hmm. Because, it always happens before you know it's happened. And there's nothing you can do about that. It's the same thing with negative self-talk. You can't prevent that from happening. If something bad happens in a competition, or if you start to feel bad, you're going to have a negative thought. It's what happens next that matters. Does it just happen and keep happening, or do you realize it's happening? Are you able to sort of step back from yourself and say, "Hey, wait a minute, this isn't helpful," and then you can make a choice. Without that self-awareness, you can't. So it's the same deal with the attentional focus. You have to realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm worried too much about what's going on in my head. I need to shift back to the task at hand.
Right. And just to put it in even more concrete terms, something that will really make sense to a lot of the listeners, basically focusing on physical cues can be huge here. I had a pitching coach that first taught me how to do this, where I would literally, if I was in my head, I would just start paying attention to the way that the ball felt on my fingers, right? I would feel the laces. I would feel each lace. I would feel the softness of the rest of the ball, the leather of the ball, or whatever the fuck that a baseball is made out of. And just the focus of that physical sensation immediately takes you out of your head. You can focus on your breath. You can focus on the knurling on a bar, the rough part of a bar, anything to, like, as you're saying, focus on the task at hand and get out of your head. Because when we're in our heads, that's when we start to mess with our mechanics and our bodies aren't able to do what we've been training them to do.
Yep, exactly. You want to be as unconscious as possible. Don't think about anything you can do automatically.
In your book, you talk about kind of the benefit of training with others. And I wanted to get your take on this. One, because I've been talking about it with a couple other coaches recently. So the legendary UNC soccer coach Anson Dorrance had what he called the competitive cauldron, where it was kind of like his secret sauce, where he had this very, very competitive culture on all of his teams, where the athletes would just push each other harder than they had ever been pushed. And so that competition in their training is what led to such quick development. Is there a time when you think training with others can actually be a detriment to people? And is there a time when you would suggest they train alone?
Yeah, the answer is yes, for sure. It happens all the time. The whole reason this, moderate intensity rut exists, well, not the whole reason, but that's one reason. If you might be able to, a workout that's supposed to be done at low intensity, you might be able to do that on your own, but as soon as you're in a group with, people with mixed abilities, you end up getting pulled along. And maybe that one workout doesn't kill you, but it's not the workout you were supposed to have done mm-hmm. on that day. There's a great example of Mark Allen, the six-time Ironman world champion from the 1990s. This is back in the day. He came up in the 80s when all the top triathletes lived in San Diego. So everyone you had to beat in the races, you're also training with every day. And he realized early on, this is not working. We're basically racing each other every day. So he had the wherewithal to pull himself out of most of the workouts, train on his own, and only show up when he was supposed to go hard. And, you know, a lot of other people just burned themselves out and he didn't.
Gotcha. Is there a middle ground in there at all where you can use that competition and training occasionally? And if so, do you have any suggestions on how to find that sweet spot?
Yeah, you have to be in control and to know what the purpose is. You know, every workout has a purpose. Mm-hmm. And it's like, if being in a group or being in a particular group facilitates that purpose, then, you know, thumbs up. Otherwise, no. It's also worth pointing out that, you know, training in a group can be beneficial for two almost contradictory reasons. One is competition, which you've mentioned a couple times. The other is actually cooperation. So, you know, in the book, I give the example of a study involving rowers. They call it behavioral synchrony. Basically, anytime you're doing a task and you're surrounded by others who are performing the same task, even if it's non-competitive, mm-hmm. it lowers perception of effort. Your brain actually produces, the neurochemicals that, the runner's high stuff, endorphins.
Right.
So that you actually, so even if it's completely a non-competitive situation, but it's exertional, being in a group can be, beneficial to performance. And there was a study involving rowers and pain tolerance that showed that their pain tolerance was actually heightened by doing the same workout in a group versus alone because of those endorphins.
What did you call that again?
Behavioral synchrony.
Oh, that's fascinating. I've kind of known that intuitively from my own experience, but I didn't know there was an actual term for that. That makes a ton of sense. That's really cool.
That's a good one.
What are two of the most impactful daily practices that people can do to improve their mindset?
Oh man, that feels like a gotcha.
two of the. Not it doesn't have to be the two most.
Oh geez. Impactful daily practices. I don't know. I'm drawing a blank. I mean, I can tell you what I do, and I don't
perfect.
Know.
If, you know, that's yeah. what I'm looking for.
Yeah. One thing I do is, because I'm a very driven, focused person and, but there's more to life than riding and running. I want a life with some balance. So one thing I do, it's sort of sacred for me every day, is a 2 mile walk in the morning with my wife and my dog. And I don't, 2 miles, that's a pretty long walk. I don't even consider it exercise. I do two proper workouts on top of that, but it's just, it's just time to just enforce balance. Like I don't always feel like I have time for it, but unless I absolutely can't, I try to do it anyway. And I find that, it helps. Yeah. It's just like, it just anchors everything else. So even though it takes an hour, each 45 minutes or whatever, up of the day, it just like, I feel like, I'm just a better, more well-rounded person for holding right. that space sacred.
Have you read the book The Power of Full Engagement by chance?
No.
Fascinating book. I can't remember the authors off the top of my head, but it talks about managing your energy rather than your time. And what you're talking about is one of the biggest concepts. It's like a very simple rejuvenating activity
right.
that you're not making yourself earn it. You're just putting it in your day and it's having this like really energizing effect, right? Like, as you said, it anchors everything else.
Yep.
That's really cool. You got one more for us?
Yeah. So, I try to not let a single day go by without reading. And so even if it's, 10 minutes, cause it's a super busy day, obviously I have an interest in that anyway. I like to read, but I feel like reading is just good for you on so many levels. Obviously, it matters what you choose, but I mean, you should choose things you like, choose things that, you know, matter to you, or, you know, just have maybe practical benefits or whatever. But I just feel like it's almost like, to me, like exercise or brushing my teeth or eating. It's like something like, it's an absolute daily must for kind of at least my mental health.
Right. How do you choose what book to read next personally?
You know, I was an English major in college. So, you know, I actually like Shakespeare. I read all these books, you know, that's my degree. I just read tons of books. And as when I graduated, I just kept right on reading the same book. So I actually read mostly fiction. And you know, I just, you know, I feel like it informs, cause you know, pretty much every, that's my standard. It's like, I try to read writers who are better than I am. Mm-hmm. And so I study the craft, not always like consciously, but you know, my vocabulary increases. I just learn, you know, useful turns of phrase so that's sort of my standards. I try to read, I don't really care so much about the subject matter. I like things that are just, extremely well written and put together.
Right.
And sort of one thing can lead to another. You know, if like I discover an author I like, I might read everything they've ever, you know, written and that sort of thing.
Right.
But I take suggestions.
Hell yeah.
I've got one from you already.
Hell yeah. I've been doing this thing recently where I am only reading fiction and I'm listening to nonfiction. And I think it has something to do with my decreasing attention span. So I don't know if I'm like empowering this bad habit of my attention span getting smaller, but it's been awesome to just read more fiction, right? It in the same way that your walk brings so much to your life, reading fiction brings so much to my life in the simplest way.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that, because for me the practical application is as a writer is much more obvious.
But right,
it's interesting.
Right.
It's interesting to me to hear you say that, you know, you feel the same.
Yeah, doing activities for no other reason than just pure enjoyment is something that I think doesn't get a whole lot of we don't put a whole lot of value in our society, but it is just so crucial to living a full life. And it's actually, I think it contributes to my success as much as, you know, a lot of the more like tangible learning experiences that I have.
Yeah. Again, I can relate so much. I mean, I'm basically unemployable because I insist on, I'm like Bartleby the Scrivener. I prefer not. Like, if I don't want to do it, I won't do it. Like, right. Seriously, like I can't hold a job where I can't just do what I want to do.
Yep. Yep. Well, hey man, you've been doing it successfully for a long time now. So that's awesome. Is there anything else related to mindset? Like any other big thing that you think is really important for people to understand or do that I didn't ask about?
Oh, well, yes, but nothing comes to mind.
Okay. Well, hey, we have time, man. We'll do a part two one day. I've got a few wrap up questions for you. So what is your most gifted book to others?
The book I give to others most often as a gift. Now this isn't fair because I've written a few, so it is one of my own, and it's Iron War. It's actually one that involves Mark Allen, the triathlete I mentioned earlier. If you like epic sports rivalries, it's like Chris Everett Lloyd and Martina Navratilova, only in triathlon.
Love it. What is a belief that you hold that if others held would have the biggest effect on their life and performance in general?
I would say it maybe more of a mindset than a belief, but I believe I view life as a blank canvas, and you can put whatever you want on it. I mean, you really can. Earlier this year at age 46, I relocated to Flagstaff because I wanted to, because it was a fantasy, and spent 3 months training with a team of professional runners who were literally half my age. and twice as gifted as I was. Just one of the most amazing experiences I ever had. And I just made it happen. You know what I mean? Cause I wanted to, and you know, the level of risk was high. It could have not turned out well, but it did. And so I like that blank canvas metaphor, I think, is something I really find myself wishing more people would experience that kind of freedom, see life that way.
Hell yeah, man. What is one action that you'd recommend people take immediately in relation to sport, life, anything?
I think they should sign up for your program, which I might do.
Nice. Nailed
it. It goes both ways. You didn't know that much about me. I didn't know that much about you. So I did some research and it looks extremely intriguing, actually.
Hell yeah, man. I appreciate that. Man, I'm on a roll. I'm stumping him.
Yeah, I'm terrible. Like, you could ask me, like, I don't know, my younger brother's name and I might flub it. I'm just not a great on my feet type of guy.
Oh, you're killing it, man. Okay, what is one thing that you've stopped doing that you think has contributed to your success?
Eating potato chips.
Just straight up potato chips?
I'll say this. I learned the lesson that people are lazy, and when it's easy to do something you don't want to do, you'll do it. At one point I told my wife, please don't bring potato chips in the home, because like, I'll let the fruit go bad so that the potato chips won't. Potato chips is sort of a metaphor, but like, we all do have a lazy streak, and so you kind of need to acknowledge that and sort of create an environment that, kind of works around that lazy streak. So potato chips is one concrete example of how I've done that.
I love that. My wife introduced me to a book that I can't remember the name of, but they created something called the Environmental Overhaul for people's kitchens. And the basic concept is that it's easier to change your environment than it is to change your mind, right?
Yes.
But we leave things up to our willpower. We leave them up to, you know, our making disciplined choices,
right,
hundreds of times throughout the day, when if we just like don't bring certain things in the house, or, you know, we put, if it's like getting out of bed in the morning, if we put all of our clothes laid out and make it really easy to get out of bed, we're just like so much more set up for success. So I think that's great advice.
Yeah. Sometimes you just need to like be gentle with yourself, and like, people, they want to do things the hard way sometimes. And yeah, exactly right. Easier to change your kitchen than your mind.
So Mark, this has been phenomenal, man. I think we have a lot in common and our passions really, really line up. I think people have some really, really good things to chew on and some practical ways to train their mindset. So this has been great, man. We have a ton of CrossFitters and endurance athletes listening to this show. Where can they go to find out more about the programs that you offer, the coaching you do, the books you've written? Where do they go?
The place to start is my personal website, mattfitzgerald.org.
And I know you have a lot of different options for runners. Can you tell us anything about what runners or people that want to run better can get out of your website and your programs?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, yeah, for really, as a coach, I coach runners and triathletes and I guess cyclists a little bit. And I really cover all three pieces. I've got, there's like a, it's a, you know, a stool with three legs, training, psychology, which is what we've focused on, and nutrition as well. So I'm actually a sports nutritionist. So, I really take a best practices approach. So I try to study like what the most successful people are doing in all these dimensions, training, nutrition, and psychology, and then sort of, you know, pass it on in practical, usable ways to athletes. So that's what you're in for. Like, I'm into science, but I'm not one of these people who like will just, you know, cite a bunch of studies and not think about how what people are actually doing in the real world. So it's kind of a best practices approach is what you're in for if you drink my Kool-Aid.
Man, I think that is honestly the mark of a true expert, because anyone at the top of their game will tell you that they don't have it all figured out. You know what I mean? Like, as soon as someone tells me that, I know that they're either an imposter, they're brand new to it, or they just really lack self-awareness. I just met with a new functional medicine doctor who introduced himself and basically said the same exact thing. He's like, I understand the science, you know, as well as I can, and I do as much research as I can, but I just don't have all of the answers. And I told him, man, that's the most refreshing thing I've heard from a doctor ever, you know.
It's almost ironic that inspires trust, right? You know, but it does.
Because you know that's authentic. That's real.
Yeah.
Well, man, thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it. I would really love to do this again one day.
Yeah, well, I can't stop writing, so I'll give you something else we can talk about down the road.
Love it, brother. Well, you have a great day. We'll talk soon.
You too.